Session number 106.13, rule 10.
After you'd finished the course at Hell One, you rejoined the Eighth, who had arrived in the Gazala box area in Egypt.
Yep.
Would that be correct?
No, that's true.
That would be sometime round about February, I suppose.
I think so. Yes, it would be roughly that.
What was the? Could you describe the Gazala box position as far as you saw it?
Yes, that's difficult. Really, if one can just imagine a large area of pretty nigh flat desert. There were undulations, so that if it was literally flat, then of course you'd see for miles and miles and miles. But within reason, you could see a lorry, shall we say, for quite a number of miles, but you had undulations in between. So from that point of view, one could really get pretty safe, shall we say, fire positions, and with pretty good open fields of fire. Other than that, the perimeter dug-in defences, in front of that you had really barbed wire about 9 inches from the ground to stop you getting into the minefield area with anti-tank mines and personnel mines. The little dugout kitchens, company cooking area. I had a dugout for myself that was the same really as everyone, from a trench point of view.
Could you just describe, I know it's daft to describe a dugout, but what proportions was it and what did it look like and what did you keep in there?
From a personal viewpoint, I just had, if you could imagine, two camp beds being the area of the dugout, and the dugout really just being about 4'6" deep, more than enough really as a cover, and on top of that you had a sort of canvas cover across the top on which you had sand covering it, from a camouflage point of view. But other than that,
they just dug down,
dug down vertically and had little steps to get out at the side.
So there was sort of little entrance.
That's right.
Space.
Yeah. And
did you actually have a camp bed in there?
I didn't have a camp bed, yep.
And what other sort of personal items would you have in there?
Well, that was about all. I mean, you just had your own kit, your change of clothing, your equipment, weapon, and personal sort of writing materials and that sort of thing. We had a little company mess dugout in the same sort of basis, which would be roughly, I'd say, a sort of a 6 foot or less than that, probably a 4 foot table, and we could sit around it. And so the shape and size was really the same as your own dugout, only just a little bit bigger to accommodate five people.
How were the dugouts lit?
We had, I think we had one tilly lamp.
What's it? Sorry.
A gas lamp, if you like. I seem to remember either that or it might have just been a simple paraffin lamp. But limited lighting, certainly.
And did the men have dugouts like this, or were they just...
No, they were basically in situ in the slit trenches.
And what pattern were the slit trenches in?
Similar to any. There was no change in the digging pattern from that point of view.
They weren't interconnected then?
Not fully, no. But very much in platoon positions, but not a full company position.
What rations did you get, and how were they made available to you?
Well, I think I would say just the normal rations. I don't think there's any great change at that time that I can recall.
What would that be?
Very much, everything was basically tinned from that point of view. But a certain amount, I seem to remember, could be cooked because we had the little company cookhouse.
Would they be?
That was Doug.
Underground as well.
That was Doug. Yep, Doug Down.
What sort of?
In fact,
everything
was Doug Down, including one's vehicles. They were dug into sort of little dugout garages, if you like.
And what sort of tins were they provide you with?
I seem to remember, really, various M&V, or, you know, meat and vegetable type of... You mean the contents? Bully, meat and vegetable. I don't recall anything like Spam or that ilk.
Were you able to buy any supplements as an officer from Canteen?
I don't remember anything like that. So we used to get canteen supplies, or Naffy supplies used to come up, and occasionally one would find oneself with the odd can of beer, which was really gold, but very, very little. And that, I mean, if there was a can of beer around, that was for everyone. Basically, we didn't seem to have anything, if you mean sort of extra for the officer's mess type of thing. I don't recall that at all. I mean, we were all very much of a kin.
So you had... Did you get enough food to eat?
Yes.
Was the lack of variety a problem, or...?
I don't know. I don't think we really thought about that.
What about water? Did you think about that?
Well, yes, that... I think the... some people don't believe it, but our arms used to be, you know, white most of the time because of the salt evaporating on, you know, in the dry season anyway, on your arms. So I would say you're basically always thirsty, but I don't think you're terribly conscious of it. You took everything in your stride there. On the other hand, one had to be careful because I think we were normally on a gallon of water a day, and that was for everything. That's for washing, shaving, what you could in the way of bathing, or, you know, sort of stand-up cleaning, and the odd cups of tea that you wanted. And when we got onto operations, we were down to half gallon a day. So it was a very, very important commodity. So I think if anything was worrying anyone, it would be the water.
Were you required to maintain your standard of appearance in view of the shortage of water? I'm thinking of personal cleanliness.
Oh, yes.
And shaving.
Yeah.
Would the men be expected?
Oh, we were all expected to, yeah.
What about latrines? What arrangements were made there?
Oh, well, that was the great, the deep trench latrine. In other words, it was, well, you just dug a hole into the ground. And, you could have... I was trying to remember what I sat on, because I can remember sitting on something, and it probably might have been one of these 4-gallon tins with a hole, you know, cut across the top and a bit of wood across and a deep hole underneath. And, of course, when that was, shall we say, used or near full or whatever, then you could fill up and dig somewhere else.
Was it strict... control on latrines? I mean...
Oh, very much so, yeah. No, otherwise... I mean, flies were a problem. Flies in the Middle East are always a problem. And,
In
if
what
you're,
way?
Well, just the flies, that's the quantity. And they are... They will carry disease. And if you're going to... what can I say? Under-emphasize the disciplines of hygiene, then you're asking for trouble.
Could you keep them off your food, or were there too many?
Well, you would always be flapping your hands, and we found that particularly in the when we first arrived in the canal area.
Were there any other? I'm thinking, particularly in the Gazala lines. Were there any other pests, desert insects or snakes or scorpions, anything like that that causes a nuisance?
Well, we met the scorpions really in the canal area more so, but. No, there were still scorpions up in the Gazala area. Also, one chap certainly jumped sky high when a snake appeared in his trench and in his blanket. I remember seeing one when I was spending a penny, actually, sitting on this thunderbox, peeking out about a couple of yards away. And I stamped my feet, and he very kindly disappeared. And I'm told that snakes are more scared of you than you are of them. But, no, other than that, the desert sores were a problem.
What caused them in your view?
These, I'm not sure about this, but I think they started with the bite. I don't think it's anything to do with sandfly fever, but I think it just had something to do with some form of bite, and then they rose up and they became difficult to actually close up, to heal. And but I had them when I was taken prisoner, and I was in the camp hospital for about 13 weeks before they finally closed up the ones that I had on my legs.
There were large swellings with open...
Not so much swellings, but open wounds, if you like. Like a burst blister.
And were they very painful?
No, not really. They're a damn nuisance, really, if anything.
Why were they a nuisance then?
Well, just because they were there, I think. It's just, it's like a spotty face. It's not very nice when you look in the mirror.
Did the weather cause any health problems, the heat?
I don't recall any, any serious problems. I think by this time we knew what it meant to respect the heat. On the other hand, I think things had changed. The fact that we were now totally acclimatized, because I don't think we were then wearing topis, for instance, whereas when we first came out to the Middle East, everyone had a topi. And I suppose that goes back to the pre-war thinking that anywhere outside of the UK or anything tropical, then you had to have a tropical hat, full stop. But once you were acclimatized, it seemed apparent that you didn't absolutely need a topi.
What would sensible precautions be against, say, sunstroke?
I would say... I don't think we could take any precautions, because basically we were fit enough to be able to stand the sun. There would be outside influences which would cause it. If we were suddenly cut down to a pint of water a day, then that might be, you'd get heat exhaustion setting in, I think, fairly quickly. And similarly, if one was being overworked in some way or another. But, those are outside influences. The individual, you're there in the middle of the desert, there's a whacking great sun. Similarly, it can be damn cold at night, in the same breath.
Were there any other health problems, or were there any health problems, besides the desert sores?
No, I think the odd case of sandfly fever may have cropped up, and I'm sure, although I can't pinpoint it, but I believe there was, occasionally you get some people down with diarrhoea. But other than that, no.
So what was the daily routine like? You were in, the enemy were a fair way away, but they were
there.
It was a frontline position. What was the daily routine from say, stand two in the morning, if you had stand two?
Well, I know you always had stand two.
And was it for you there? What did you do at stand two?
Well, you occupied every position in your defensive position, wherever you were allocated. And thereafter you'd bring in, we did have a gap guard, for that matter, because one gap through the minefield was in the middle of my company area, and they would be brought in as a sideliner, something that always used to annoy me, and bless their hearts, they were very trusting chaps, the Geordies, but I used to go out and wander about beyond the gap, and then come back, and in it took ages before they would challenge me, because when I was coming back towards the gap, and I used to say, look, for God's sake, there are plenty of Germans who are the same shape and size as me, and you must challenge everyone who comes. Oh, but we knew who it was. We knew it was you, sir, and so on and so forth. And it took ages before, bless their hearts, they would sort of have the temerity, or whatever they thought, to actually challenge me on the way back.
While we're on the gap guard, what was the gap guard? How many men and what sort of...
It was, I think, an NCO, three or four. Just a very small one.
And what were they armed with?
Just with their own personal weapons. The main thing, really, was to make sure that the gap was covered, and not surprised. It could have been done, really, I think, from the main position, but it was the thing that I think we took over, and we just left it that way.
So the stand two, was everybody stood two?
Yep. Yes. As far as I'm concerned, the whole lot.
Was it at dawn or at any...
Just before dawn, and to about half an hour after daybreak, yep. And then breakfast. Weapon cleaning was a constant.
What problems did the desert pose for weapon cleaning for the men?
Sand. Sand was the biggest problem, because basically the fine sand would get anywhere. And of course the other side of the coin is that you really had to just walk over a bit of desert, and you would crunch up the sand, if you like, into finer sand. And for that matter, any trucks going through my gap would cast a cloud of fine sand across the wind.
How did you clean that from your weapons?
Well, one just had to, use Forma 2, the usual cleaning. There was nothing really clever about it. It just had to be constantly monitored, and I think one cleaned the weapons a little more often than you would have done in UK.
And was it a daily task, or...?
I'd say more than a daily task, because there wasn't a great deal more that one could do. One could take on minor exercises, shall we say, a very minor inside, and then later on when I think it was after we had a change of CO, but that's not the point, that we had certain exercises outside of the
I'll come to
box.
That if we could stick to more the sort of while you were in the box,
yeah.
A typical day, so you'd set the men, would you, well, the men would be on this sort of work. What would you be doing in the morning after breakfast?
But basically I think that one would be going round the platoon positions and really maintaining contact with the platoons. I'm just trying to cast my mind back. Anything of an administrative date, believe it or not, we used to have company petty sessions in those days. You couldn't confine anyone to barracks, but you could, in fact, give them a reprimand or something like that to just try and remind them that if anybody was putting a foot wrong, that we're all part of a bloody great team. And we don't want anyone letting the side down. Similarly, on one of these petty sessions, we had one chap up on interview. It was a new officer, we keep names out of this, but who was a Londoner. And he'd called one of the platoon a bastard. Well, you can call a Geordie a bugger, but you can't call him a bastard. Similarly, I think I'm right in saying that you can call a Cockney a bastard, but you must never call him a bugger. And this soldier, quite rightly, was up for interview with the company commander because he'd been called a bastard, and they didn't think it was right. And absolutely, I said, look, I see your point of view, and I'll see that something's done about it. And I had a quiet word with the officer. I said, look, for God's sake, don't call Geordie's bastard. And so that was one point that was settled. And that was one activity, if you like,
so
in the day.
A continuation of ordinary routine.
That is so, yeah.
And what else would you do? So is lunchtime approached? Or would this carry on all day, this sort of patrolling? And this?
Well, no, it's...
checking the men out. And
yes. In a way, yes. You may have, in between whiles, you may have, CO's conference. You may have these outside exercises. You may have... we had a concert party up on one occasion, and that was very tricky in the simplest of terms, because one said, all right, well, you can all come out and watch and listen, but at the drop of a hat or a blow of a whistle, everybody's got to disappear smartly into a stand-two position. We should have practiced stand-twos as well, so that we wouldn't be caught napping.
And that was sort of... The men would be... What would the men spend their time doing? Cleaning their weapons?
Yep. And in many ways, they had a very dull time. There's always letter writing and letter reading, but that doesn't take up much of the day.
You'd check the guards. They'd have guards, sentries rather, posted, I presume.
Oh, from that point of view, yes. But, I mean, that would be an automatic routine throughout the time.
Day and
night. Yeah.
And what about in the evening? Were there any special jobs you do then?
No, not really. I mean, you stood tall in the evening until after dark, and of course, sentries were still mounted. And
you mostly get your sleep at night rather than have to catch your sleep during the day.
That's right. Yep. Prior to the Gazala battle, that is the case.
Were you during the early phase, really, and the quiet phase? Were you under fire at all?
We had the odd, not very much, in fact. We had the odd shells over. None of my chaps were involved, but some people just behind, you know, what did I say? I don't think they were even DLI. There were other people who were attached. There were no casualties as a death. There were one or two people wounded. We did have an unfortunate thing in the next company where a patrol came in, a foot patrol, and inadvertently got into, they did a full circle, came in and unfortunately went over this tripwire into the minefield. And I can't remember which company that was, but one or two people were lost in that way. But we had odd aircraft came across, and later on when there was a 9DLI were sending out a mobile patrol and it was forming up, and that was Stuttgart.
Were the patrols for any, what kind of patrols would you send out? How big would a patrol be? What was its purpose?
We had a standing patrol out about a mile, a standing patrol and, if you like, listening, but it was more than that. It was a full platoon of 30 chaps. With a section of Bofa guns and a section of, that was I think three Bofa guns, and two machine guns, medium machine guns.
So quite powerful.
Well, in a little, it's a nice little outpost, and that was out 24 hours. So it was, in fact...
And they were dug in?
Oh, yes, and they were, shall we say, a sort of a straight left being held out in front of the Gazala line. You know, don't pass this point, otherwise we'll shoot. And so, a deterrent, there were...
How did they maintain communications with you if they were
cable,
a while out?
By cable.
Cable,
yeah.
Not wireless.
No. Another patrol was two vehicles, two 1,500 weights, with six men each, or an NCO and six men each, with a captain commanding it, would tour the front area. Bear in mind that at this time the South African armoured cars used to hold a watching brief on forward ridges, and if there was any enemy movement they would drop back to the next ridge. And we would, in this mini 2,500 weight patrol, would wander around the no man's land, liaise with the South African armoured cars, and then move down. So it'd be out all day.
Would you ever go out?
I did. I went out on there. Yeah.
And the second in command would look after the company while you were out.
That's right.
Did you ever see the Germans while you were out on this? I presume you wouldn't if the South Africans.
No. I believe there was a lovely case when who is he still about? Woods. I think it was Captain Woods. Another company, it wasn't my company, but apparently he went up. Towards some armoured cars, or an armoured car rather, and I think it might have been slightly adrift, or certainly adrift from the South Africans, because the way he told it was magnificent, because he said that I was driving with his two 1,500 weights and saw this armoured car and thought, right, well, I better go and liaise. And then it occurred to me that the South African armoured car didn't have six wheels, and they said the closer I got to it, I suddenly realised that colours were slightly different, and there was a dirty great black cross on the side of it, and so I stopped. There was no point in dashing away. Now, we only had Bren guns, and as opposed to whatever this thing had, probably a 2-pounder or something. And so I got out, told the charge to stay where they were, but point the guns towards the armoured car, went over, and out popped a chap, spoke fairly perfect English, and asked how everyone was and how, you know, London and so on. He hadn't been there for a while, but he had been to Oxford, and we had a good old chat, And finally he said, well, cheerio, you better go your way. And I said, well, that's grand, and you may as well go your way. And we parted company. And in a way, that's a slight illustration of some of the spirit of, shall we say, Rommel's men, as opposed to some of the other Germans.
Were there any other types of patrol?
Yes, there's one major patrol. This is rather like the one that 9DLI was forming up when they were Stuttgart. And Ross McLaren took this one out.
This Roscoll.
Roscoll, that's right.
So is this what they call a jock column?
I suppose, yes, be fairly simple. I always rather imagined a jock column as being a little faster moving, because this was a fairly cumbersome job. But I think I thought the jock columns would rather have to be quickly darting in, a little more than we were. Because it's a fairly hefty thing to control, and we moved rather slowly, I think, in the desert, whether it was a question of springs.
Were you on this, Roscoll?
No, I wasn't. But I saw it go out, because it formed up outside my area and disappeared. But, no, it was surprised, I think. It's one of those things. A certain number of people did get back, but I think that's where Ross McLaren was captured, surely. Memories.
You never went on one of these more these fighting.
No, not the big jobs. No.
Now you were you got a new colonel during this time. Where did so Beard left?
Yes, he went off to become a brigadier somewhere, and then we got Colonel Jake Jackson, who wasn't DLI, but he was somebody I would say after Ian English's heart, because he's a very much a pusher. And what can you say, an extrovert type in many ways, an aggressive chap, just really the sort of chap, a good leader.
Was he aggressive in his personal life or just in his military life?
I didn't get enough time to really assess that, but I had, what can I say, some discussions with him, and I wrote in my own position, and on various facets of trying to keep the dust down is one big problem when you're firing a weapon, particularly Britain, where you get a little sort of the recoiled air can blast dust. And there's one thing I seem to remember. I think we disagreed on that, which
did he mind people disagreeing with him?
I have a feeling he didn't like it, but I mean that's fair enough. He's the boss, and he was less likely to like it, I think, than Tim Beard.
And you also became second in command as opposed to commander of Seaford. Was that after Jackson arrived?
That was after Jackson arrived, that's right, yeah.
Was there any reason why you'd lost?
No. Tony, I can't remember where Tony Jones came from, but he was a supplementary reserve officer, nice chap, and he came up, and what I can't remember either is where my second in command went, because he wouldn't go as third in command, really. Anyway, Tony Jones took over. He was much senior to me, mind you.
Did you mind? I mean,
no, not really, because it's the I'd been up and down since the beginning of the war anyway, and you just fit it in as long as you're with the battalion. That's really the main point.
So you didn't feel slighted at having, because
no, Tony was a splendid chap anyway to have as a senior, as an OC, and B, he was a senior by a fair amount to me, and the other side of the coin is, as always, if the CO wants a thing doing, you tell him what to do it, and that's it.